Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Mark Price. He is the author of C Sharp 8.0 and .NET Core 3.0 Modern Cross-Platform Development. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Jesse. How are you?
I'm good, good. Very excited to have you here and to talk about your book, which is in its fourth edition and according to Amazon is a bestseller, which doesn't really surprise me, having looked through the book and read good parts of it.
It's had a fantastic reception. I'm very pleased that by the fourth edition, it's now got to that kind of perfect place of, having been revised over four editions, I think it's in a really solid position.
Well, it's hard to do well in the computer book industry these days, and I think you've broken through in a way that is unusual.
Yeah, I'm really pleased to hear you say that, considering your extensive history with authoring dozens of books, many of which a decade ago I was learning from myself. So thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Well, that's very kind, although the key phrase in there was a decade ago or so. So it is hard to keep up with the technology, and it's certainly hard to convey all of that in a single book. But I must say that your book is incredibly extensive and takes the reader from essentially what is C Sharp and what's a variable all the way through advanced programming with .NET Core.
Yes, my goal in writing the book was looking at the primary audience of someone who wants to get started with C Sharp and .NET as it is today, the modern way of doing development, in particular cross-platform. And then the secondary audience would be perhaps people who have looked at C Sharp and .NET in the past, maybe 20 years ago when the first versions were coming out, but maybe have moved into more of a management role and they want to get back into .NET and C Sharp and see what's new, especially now that .NET Core 3 has surpassed what the capabilities of .NET Framework are. It's definitely where now is the time for existing .NET Framework developers who maybe haven't kept up to date with all the modern stuff. Now's the time to make that jump, ready for later in this year, the final unification of .NET again in November.
Can you say a little bit about the differences in the frameworks and why they're important?
Yeah, so there are, I now see, and I think Microsoft sees, .NET Framework as being the legacy platform that is tightly integrated with the Windows operating system. It will still be maintained and supported for at least another 10 years. But with .NET Framework 4.8, that is the last major version of that branch of .NET. It's very mature, has a lot of great technologies in it, from ASP.NET web forms to MVC, and for Windows desktop development. It's got all of that stuff in there, but it wasn't ready, or wasn't available really to take Microsoft into the future, which is cross-platform. And so Microsoft has spent the last 4 or 5 years now rebuilding .NET from nothing using this project called .NET Core in order to make it cross-platform and really be able to take advantage of rewriting the internals to get much better performance and scalability and to embrace just the newer technologies rather than having to continue to support some of the older tech that's still part of the .NET framework. And coming later this year with .NET 5.0 in November, that .NET Core platform will become the one true unified version of .NET, the one ring to rule them all, as it were. And that's a really exciting time now to be a .NET developer.
Anyone who can give me a Lord of the Rings reference is, you know, going to do great on this podcast.
Well, I'm glad I managed to slip that one in there.
Let's talk about your book some. There are a number of topics, and as I said earlier, it's very, very extensive. Can you talk a little bit about the range of topics covered and how you decided to include or not include? Although there's not much you didn't include, I have to say.
Yes, absolutely. So as the title suggests, C Sharp 8 and .NET Core 3, modern cross-platform development, that's what I try to focus on in this book. So it's divided quite neatly into three parts. The first part, which is the first six chapters, covers the C# 8 language. So you'll learn everything from declaring variables to writing branching and looping statements, including all the brand new features of C# 8, like switch expressions and default interface implementations, all the way through to full object-oriented programming, inheritance and handling exceptions and all of this sort of stuff, as well as, of course, important skills like debugging. So that's the first part of the book. The second part of the book covers .NET Core 3, and that is a platform and a library of classes that you can then use to implement common features of most applications. That might include working with files in the file system, or implementing multitasking, or connecting to relational databases, or more modern style NoSQL type databases like MongoDB. And so after learning the language, you then learn all of the powerful pre-built Lego bricks that you can then combine together into an application, which leads into the third part of the book, which is building modern type applications. And so the most popular platform for development these days is, of course, the web. And so the first chapter goes into using ASP.NET Core to build a simple website. Then we look at more advanced websites using the MVC, Model View Controller Design Pattern. We then take it even further by looking at a brand new chapter that's actually in the fourth edition on content management systems. Because what I found in my in the past, I would often be teaching training courses on how to learn C# or ASP.NET MVC. But at the end of that, when people then developers then go into the real world, they realize, well, yes, it's important to understand C# and the .NET libraries and how to build an MVC application. But what they're really being employed to implement are content management systems, which allow a business user, a non-technical user, to manage their own content. And those are often built on top of .NET MVC, but they have their own ways of doing development. So I wanted to include a brand new chapter in this fourth edition about CMSs, .NET CMSs. And the one that I picked was Piranha CMS, which is fantastic for .NET Core developers because it's been built on .NET Core for a couple of years now, since the very early versions, whereas some of the other existing CMSs tend to be more still stuck on .NET Framework. But it's also a nice, simple, clean, very fast and efficient CMS as well. So it can actually be learned in about 50 pages. Other chapters in that final kind of part cover things like the ML.NET class libraries for adding machine learning intelligence. That's another of the new chapters in the fourth edition. And of course, building web services and calling web services. And right at the end, I even have time to squeeze in some Windows desktop development and mobile development with Xamarin, which I know is Xamarin is one of your expertises. So I hope I didn't embarrass myself too much with the chapter on Xamarin.
No, they're excellent. And as appropriate, you focused on Xamarin Forms, which is rapidly becoming the primary way of building Xamarin applications.
That's what I don't do a lot of mobile development myself, but yes, that's what I've heard, and so I'm pleased to hear from you, the expert, that that is the best thing to focus on if I'm going to have a chapter on mobile development in my book.
If you keep flattering me, we're going to have you back on the podcast very soon. Let's back up and talk about C# for a bit, and C# 8 specifically. Are there features in C# 8 that you are particularly fond of that you think make C# 8 a significant increment from C# 7?
Compared to C# 7, the big feature that Microsoft is most proud of is, I think most people have probably heard of this, nullable reference types, or NRTs, as it's often simplified into the acronym. Now, I wouldn't say I'm especially fond of that feature, but it's a really important thing to understand. Null support in programming languages is often called the billion-dollar mistake. And probably the most frequent exception that happens in a .NET application are null reference exceptions. So anything that a programming language designer can do to make it easier and better for a developer to be able to handle those null values, I'm 100% in favor of. And I think one of the key things that Microsoft did with C# 8 when they introduced null reference types or nullable reference types is that they made it optional. So I think a lot of developers were maybe a little bit nervous when Microsoft first started talking about this, that they would make it mandatory. That would have, I think, prevented a lot of people from moving from C# 7 up. Luckily, they've made it optional. You can either at the project level or at an individual file level enable the new feature so that you start getting the warnings if you are mishandling your nulls, while not being forced to completely rewrite your code immediately. And suddenly a project has hundreds of thousands of potential warnings in it, which of course would be a bit overwhelming.
Yes, to say the least. Can you build on what you were saying and explain how nullable references help protect you from null reference exceptions?
Right, yes. So in the past, if you had, for example, a method with a parameter that was being passed in, 99% of the time, those parameters would reference a class instance. And classes, as well as containing the memory address of an actual object, can contain a null value in the situation where it hasn't been assigned to an actual object yet. And so because of the possibility of a null being passed into, say, a method invocation, if you're not very careful within your code and constantly check all 99% of your variables, if you don't check before you try and access that, whether it has a null value in it, then it's going to throw a null reference exception. And this is why it was one of the most common exceptions that occur in .NET applications, is because it becomes extremely annoying having to do all of these if checks constantly. It's the very first thing inside all your parameters. For safety reasons, you'd want to check that. So now that we have the ability to decorate our code with additional instructions to indicate how we want to handle nulls, like whether we expect a value to potentially have a null value or whether we want to restrict it to say that I don't want to assume that it might have a null value, I want to know that it's always has a valid reference, so I can simplify my code, then we can now decorate our code in that way and simplify our code in a safe way. But it can still get quite complicated. And one of the key things that I think a lot of Microsoft people have been trying to get into our developers' heads is that now that C# 8 has this ability to more clearly identify how a class library or how you want your code to interpret nulls or work with nulls, please start using it. Because once we get to .NET 5 at the end of this year, most of the Microsoft libraries will be following those kind of design patterns of null handling. And Microsoft really wants us to spend the next 9 months at least looking at it and starting to implement that.
One of the questions that I've gotten quite a bit is why that's needed when there is the null conditional and null coalescing operators.
I think it just makes things clearer and stricter. Things like the null coalescing, it's a convenience, but it doesn't, anyone outside your method doesn't know whether you're going to be using that or not. One of the benefits of the additional null handling is the ability to decorate your methods and your class libraries with additional information that not only tells the compiler what to expect, but also other developers who are maybe then using your class library. Whereas things like the null coalescing, it's a convenience that you can use in your internal implementations, but it doesn't tell anyone else what you're doing.
Right. That makes good sense. You had said, and interestingly, when I had Mads Turgeson on, he said that the null reference types are the most significant update or change in C# 8. And I'm fascinated by that because there are a lot of other things going on in C# 8. I do understand the need to protect developers from null reference exceptions. I get them, as everybody gets them, you know, by the dozen. So if we can prevent that, or greatly reduce that, that's going to be very, very powerful. Before I move on to some of the other topics in C# 8, let me ask you one more thing about null reference types, and that is they provide warnings. And I know that the best practice is to treat warnings as errors, but most people don't. And so the question is how NRTs are going to really provide that assistance if they're lost in a sea of warnings.
That could very well be the case that despite Microsoft giving us some good advice, like treat warnings as errors, and good advice, like start switching on these extra attributes in order to indicate how a class library should work and how it's expecting null values or not to be passed in. Despite all of that, it could be the case that when .NET 5 comes out, there are still a lot of third-party libraries that do not follow that best practice. And at that point, I think Microsoft may have to make a decision about what they're going to do in 2021 in order to prepare us for .NET 6. As with any developer platform, the designers of the language may have some ideas that they think are good, but years go by, developers maybe just don't embrace them, and so they quietly disappear. That could be the case with nullable reference types. Only time will tell. I hope that developers will see the genuine benefits of using them. But if it's a case of only the Microsoft libraries actually use them and everybody else effectively ignores them, then we'll see less benefit.
Well, one of the ways that I have found that makes them very beneficial is that every time I get a null reference exception, I look to see whether there was a warning that would have protected me from that. And that provides reinforcement of the need and utility of the feature.
That's a really good idea. I'm going to start disciplining myself to do more of that myself.
Let's move on to other aspects of C# 8. One of the things that I find really powerful are switch expressions and some of the new syntax in switch expressions. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how you've been using it personally in your own coding?
Yes. So in the past, we've had the switch statements, but the switch statement is fairly verbose in that it's a branching statement. You can specify a variable or expression and then specify different case values for that. So in the case where a variable is 10, here's a block of code that I want to run. Or in the case where it's 20, here's another block that I want to run. But those traditional switch statements, as I say, are fairly verbose. Switch expressions really simplify that. In some ways, I'd use the analogy of lambda expressions. So back in C# 3 was when Microsoft first introduced lambda expressions, which are also known as nameless functions. And what Microsoft was basically doing there is taking the minimum kind of expression of what a function actually is and providing a really simplified syntax for that. And so they've done the same for switch statements when they've converted them now into or given you the option of using switch expressions. It's a really succinct, literally expression of what a switch is. So you can still specify the different case values. You specify what the expression is. For the default, you can just use the underscore. And it can really shorten the amount of code that you're writing. And it's so much easier to read. You can very clearly see what's going to happen in the various different branches. So I love them. In some ways, I think switch expressions are one of my favorite features in C# 8. Even though NRTs are more important, switch expressions, it's one of those niceties that just makes C# more pleasant to use, along with some improvements to things like tuples and that type of thing. These small minor improvements are in some ways things that you come across every day and just make C# development just much more pleasant.
Let's pick up on that a bit, because using tuples is fairly intuitive. The learning curve is fairly easy. And if you go to old code, legacy code, you can pretty rapidly see where a tuple is going to save you and help you with refactoring. Yes. But switch expressions are a little more difficult. If you come across a switch statement in legacy code, it's hard to see how you convert that into switch expression. Do you have any advice for people who are in the process of doing that?
I don't have any specific advice. What I've found is that half of my switch statements can naturally, you can immediately see how it can be changed into an expression, whereas maybe the more complex ones that have literally blocks of code, those maybe I would just say leave it as a switch statement. Use these niceties when they feel natural, But don't force yourself to use a new feature just because you feel like I've got to use the new thing. The old stuff still works. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. But there is a temptation with something new and shiny, especially switch expressions where you know that there's greater efficiency, to want to take some of these large switch statements and make them a bit more readable and understandable.
Yeah. And maybe some of the parts of the way that you might have implemented it using a switch statement, perhaps doing some more extensive refactoring, turning some of those lines of statements into separate method calls, that might actually enable you to therefore use the switch expression. So that desire to use the benefits of a switch expression might force you to refactor some other parts of your code as well. So that can kind of be a side benefit.
Well, having talked about switch expressions and tuples, we can back up a little bit and talk about pattern matching enhancements in C# 8. So we've talked about tuples, we've talked about switch expressions and certainly nullable reference types. Are there other new features in C# 8 that you're particularly excited about?
The one that comes to mind that's potential is the default interface implementations. It's a fairly controversial new feature because in some ways it does break the original idea behind an interface being a contract that never changes. And so if you do start adding in additional members of that interface by leveraging that new feature, a lot of people would say, well, you're breaking the whole idea behind that. And that's why it can be a bit controversial. On the other hand, one of the reasons that I like C# is that it's always been a very practical language. And so Microsoft has made design decisions around the language that balances the purity of the language with we need to get stuff done. C# and the .NET framework are often used by enterprise developers. Enterprise developers are less concerned about implementing pure code, following pure design patterns, and more interested in being able to be productive quickly. And so features like default interface implementations, it can have practical benefits, even if it's not as pure as some may like. And any new feature like that, it's optional. If you don't like it, don't implement it. So I'm glad that that exists.
Switching on you just a bit, C# is a very powerful, very exciting language, and I've certainly been invested in it highly since 2000 when the first bits came out. Good Lord, that's 20 years ago. But it is not the most popular language on the planet. And there are other languages such as Ruby and any number of other web languages that are more popular than C#. Can you talk a little bit about why a new developer would pick up C# instead of one of the others?
My personal opinion is that C# is a good language to start with because it is similar to some of those other rival languages like Java, in that it is a statically typed, object-oriented language. It has a lot of safety features that help beginner developers helps them to avoid common mistakes. And it's a very practical language for actually getting a job at the end of it. 10 years ago, I was working for a training company that provided bootcamp courses to get developers quickly up to speed on, in our case, Microsoft developer languages like C#, and then get certified on the Microsoft exams. And the number of times we had students, junior developers who had just started their first job and their businesses had sent them on a course to learn C# and ASP.NET and MVC development and so on. And the reason was because at universities in the United Kingdom, the academics may not be as pro-Microsoft as businesses, and so would insist on teaching Java or Python or Fortran even.
Oh, good Lord.
Yes. or Prolog was a language that I had to learn at university. So these other languages, which have their benefits for sure, but businesses don't use as many of those languages to actually build real apps. Partly historically, because businesses tend to have a big investment in Microsoft, both on Windows Server, SQL Server, and of course the Office product. So it's kind of natural to then follow Microsoft on the developer platform as well. But also because Microsoft has always been fantastic at creating these developer platforms. They do make enterprise development super easy and very productive. And with the cloud development with Microsoft Azure now, it's a fantastic developer platform. And so if you are new to programming, I think C Sharp should be one of the arrows in your quiver. I would also recommend languages like Python, particularly if you're interested in data science or machine learning. Python is one of the best languages for doing that. And of course, then you've got JavaScript on the client side. So having two or three languages that you are familiar with, languages which are complementary or cover different styles of development. So C Sharp, great, statically typed, object-oriented language. JavaScript, a bit more functional with prototypes instead of true classes and object-oriented. Something like Python, a bit more flexible with dynamic typing. It gives you an appreciation for the differences in languages and the grammars and so on. You'll be a better C Sharp developer simply by learning things like JavaScript and Python. I would never restrict myself to a single language, but C Sharp's a great one to start with.
I have a course that I give fairly often called TypeScript for C Sharp Programmers. And the premise of that is that TypeScript is seen by many people as an extension of JavaScript, which literally it is, but it's in many ways far closer to C Sharp than it is to JavaScript, because it provides that type safety and true objects and so forth. Have you worked with TypeScript at all? Do you see that relationship? Does that make sense?
That does make sense. I have not worked with it myself. It's been on my backlog, as it were, of things to potentially learn. And interestingly, I think now that we have Blazor, and in particular Blazor WebAssembly, I wonder whether the motivation for TypeScript may have lessened. What do you think about that?
If I knew more about Blazor, I could give you an intelligent answer. I'm very interested to see whether and who adopts Blazor as a way of building web applications.
Absolutely. I know that Microsoft is very interested as well. And the thing that fascinates me about Blazor is that there are so many different flavors of it now that Microsoft are talking about. So you've got the Blazor server that was released with .NET Core 3.0 back in September. And that has a nice clean app model. You can build your reusable user interface components. And instead of having to use, say, a Microsoft technology like XAML that you might have had to do if you were implementing Silverlight 10 years ago, web developers can still use their HTML and CSS skills, but a Microsoft developer, a C#.NET developer, can use C# and the .NET libraries rather than having to learn JavaScript or one of these JavaScript libraries like Angular, React, or Vue. And I think that's going to be really popular. And the fact that with Blazor Server, your C# and .NET code is still executing on the server, I think one of the benefits of that flavor of Blazor is that because it's running the server, you've got full access to all your server resources. So it's really simple to connect to a relational database and pull back some data. You don't need to be making any kind of REST calls. It's only the visual updates that need to be made to the browser's document object model, the DOM, that are being sent via Signaler, which can be using those low-level full duplex communication protocols like WebSockets to do those updates. And apparently, Microsoft has put massive amounts of effort into making sure that you can have 10,000 active clients working on a Blazor server app. But it's also interesting. So that's Blazor server. That's one hosting model for the Blazor app model. But you can take that same user interface defined using HTML and CSS and your C# code, but then simply by turning it into a Blazor WebAssembly app, your code is then actually going to get compiled into WebAssembly and run directly inside the browser. And it seems as if that Blazor WebAssembly is what a lot of .NET developers are really excited about, because it means that they don't have to learn TypeScript and Angular in order to build a single page application. They don't have to learn Vue or React. They can continue to write their code in C# and .NET and have all the benefits of leveraging those skills while still having a web user interface. And just like a spa would, it can then make REST calls back to the server in order to fetch live data or whatever. It really is like everything old, like Silverlight, is new again. Or did Jesse, you wrote a book on Windows Store apps for Windows 8, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
there was a moment in time when Windows 8 came out. When was that? 2012, Windows 8. And so Microsoft was making a big deal about Windows Store apps, and that they could, so underneath you had the Windows runtime, full access to the Windows operating system, but they enabled you to create those Windows Store apps using either C# and .NET, or C++, or HTML and CSS and JavaScript. And so I kind of had flashbacks to that technology when I've been recently researching Blazor and some of these other options. Because what was going on back then is that you had your sandbox into which you could be writing your JavaScript code and your HTML and CSS in order to create a Windows Store app, or what is now known as a Universal Windows Platform app, UWP app. Now, I mentioned earlier that I used to work for a training company who ran boot camps. And so we used Microsoft official courses as the main material when we're teaching those courses. And so Microsoft at the time was very keen on this idea of using web technologies to build Windows Store apps. And one of the arguments that they made was that back in 2012, there may have been 5 million .NET developers, C# .NET developers, but there were 50 million web developers. And so they wanted to say, hey, 50 million web developers, come and build Windows Store apps. Now, what we found at this training company is that we offered both a 5-day training course on building Windows Store apps using HTML and CSS and JavaScript, but also using C# and .NET. And we sold a few of the C# .NET courses, didn't sell a single course on building Windows Store apps using HTML. So although the potential number of developers with the skills for building those apps was massive, it turned out that people simply didn't want to build Windows Store apps. Now, my personal opinion is that was more to do with Windows Store than to do with using web technologies to build apps. Blazor.
Yes, we know Windows Store was a huge success.
Yeah, absolutely.
And while I've interrupted you, you've brought up Silverlight twice, and I think that's just cruel.
Oh, why is that cruel? Do you have a stake in Silverlight?
Yeah, I made my living at Microsoft from 2005 to 2012, basically working with the Silverlight teams, and I can still show you my scars. But I'm still a big believer in Silverlight. I think for its time, it was a huge breakthrough.
I absolutely agree. When Silverlight 2 came out with support for C# and .NET, I was convinced that that was the future. And I know a lot of people within Microsoft believed. And the first Azure portals were all Silverlight as the front end, weren't they? Yeah, so Silverlight was a wonderful technology. It's as you've mentioned, you have the scars, and it was, of course, Steve Jobs who killed Silverlight as a kind of side product of banning Flash on iPhone. If iPhone hadn't taken off, if Steve Jobs didn't hate the horrible implementations of Flash that was so slow, if he had maybe at least allowed Silverlight, because that was much better, smaller, lightweight, faster platform, things may have been different. But I do see Blazor WebAssembly and some of the hybrid apps that Microsoft is experimenting with as being potentially Silverlight 2.0, the resurrection of the principle of Silverlight, but of course with HTML and CSS instead of XAML as being the user interface, the markup language.
Yes, and we could have a whole show on XAML and the advantages and disadvantages, and Microsoft has still implementing certainly Xamarin Forms and a number of other technologies with XAML without yet, at least for Xamarin Forms, a true designer, although that's getting better with hot reloading. But I'm taking you down a rabbit hole. Let me ask you instead, how much do you cover unit testing in your book?
Unit testing is introduced in the book. So there is a task, step-by-step instructions that gets the reader to deliberately create a project with some errors in it and then use unit tests in order to identify those and fix them. I would love to have more space. All of the topics that I cover in the book, I try and take it to that point where the reader understands the basic feature or the importance of something like unit testing. They've seen a real example working, code executing, so that they can really visualize, okay, I see how that works. And then I give as many references to either the official docs.microsoft.com links or to great blog posts, so that they can then take it further. What I'm hoping that any reader of my book gets out of it is that they can see the broad landscape of the things that they can do with C# 8 and .NET Core, the types of applications they can build, the importance of things like unit testing, and then have the confidence to take it further on their own, or to buy someone else's book. There are lots of kind of expert level books out there, written by our colleagues in the industry that are fantastic. I would love to see my book being the starting point, and then for readers to take it a lot further.